Here on the Wallet Win podcast, you know we love to jump into the practicals of managing your money. Well, today we're going to come at it from a little bit more of the philosophical side. I think you're really going to love this one.
Welcome to the Wallet Win podcast. Each week we take a look at a different piece of the personal finance puzzle. I'm Jonathan Texera.
And I'm Amanda Texera. We're your guides on your journey to getting out of debt, building wealth, and changing the world through generosity.
Here we go.
Today on the show, we have a really special guest today. I'm excited to chat with him. We have Executive Director of New Polity, Jacob Imam, here on the show. Thank you for joining us today, Jacob.
Hey, thanks so much for the invitation. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, we are thrilled to have you join us. We've had many people, you know, through email, or we've, you know, run into them at church, or even in my Instagram DMs over the last month, because we just embarked on a Catholicism and Money series, and they have been telling us, I want an interview with Jacob. Can you reach out to him? Talk to him. He said so many interesting things. And then I found, you know, the conversations that you've had over at New Polity, and kind of dove deep into that, kind of binged a few of them, was so intrigued and so interested and just grateful that you are sharing the fruits of your contemplation over the relationship between virtue and money. So I'm thrilled to have this discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's so many intersections between finance and faith. We cannot cover them all today. But today, I think what you do a great job is of kind of looking at, right, I don't know if you call it the deeper level or the higher level, some level of looking at the philosophy behind some of these things. And so I think today it would be great if we could chat about virtue and suffering. Of course, really exciting topics that come to mind when you think money. But just how I think a lot of times today, there's a temptation or a signal, a message from the world out there of, hey, through your money, you can escape suffering and you can arrive at this time or this place in your life where you don't have to worry about that anymore. No work, no worries, nothing wrong in your life. And it's all through our credit card. So I just want to dive into that a little bit today and wherever else the conversation might take us.
Yeah, awesome. That's great.
Well, as we dive in, if you could, though, for folks that maybe have not heard of you before or been blessed to be introduced to your thoughts on this, mm-hmm. can you just tell us about New Polity and kind of how you got started with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So New Polity is a think tank on one side and kind of a venture studio on the other. So in terms of the think tank, we're looking back at the Catholic tradition and seeing what the Catholic social teaching on a whole array of various issues are. But really, they all focus around this idea that Christ instituted a real kingdom, that Christ is a true king, and that as a result, life is fundamentally different from every other kingdom under every other king. And that our relationship to other citizens as a result radically changes as a result of the goodness of the gospel. So that's the think tank side where we're doing this deep dive into patristic thought, into medieval thought, into modern Catholic social teaching. And then on the other side, we're trying to apply it as best that we can here in our small Rust Belt town of Steubenville, Ohio, where we once had a big population of around 80,000. We've dwindled down to 17 with the departure of the mills and the mines. And we still have a number of marvelous friends around here, the highest percentage of HUD housing in the U.S. by the last tick at it. And there's a lot of work to do and a lot of people to serve and a lot of neighbors to love. So we are trying to do that all here through this venture of ours.
Awesome. And how did you become interested in kind of this intersection of our Catholic faith and finances?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a town called Redmond, Washington, which is the home of Microsoft, kind of the Silicon Valley of the North in many ways. And there was an immense amount of wealth in the rise of the nouveau riche was all there, and finding that people coming to have money for the first time without having a tradition that really ever told them what money was for and how to use it well. Most importantly, how to use it to become a saint. Because everything we do in this life, it's either drawing us closer to God or pushing us further away from Him. There's no middle ground on that. And so our money's either, you know, my money's either paving my way to hell or is it's helping me get to heaven, you know? And there's, and you know, it's kind of a hard truth. And nobody was really aware of that, you know, growing up. And when I came into the church several years ago and found that just this absolute excitement to be in this great tradition, to have the Eucharist, to have confession, to have the sacraments. And yet I found outside of that, the pattern and order of my life really wasn't all that different. You know, if you were to kind of track my hours through the day, it really doesn't look all that different from the atheist next door. And I think we see that a lot in the States as a whole. Somebody who might be, say, just radically for the Republican Party lives right next door in the same suburb, hoping for the same things for their kids as the guy who is a radical Democrat. You know, the pattern and order of the American life is largely the same all across. We have a larger, what we call a liberal, what the church has traditionally called a liberal paradigm, a way of thinking about the world that does circulate around contracts, around money. And Christ calls us to something so much more to that than that, so much more beautiful, something that really does bring us so much more joy. And by the blessing of His grace, I ran into a friend or two that helped me point out that that was indeed what He had placed in my heart, and that's what I was looking for, and I'm just very excited about it. Life is so much better, and I'm very, you know, very pumped to share it with other people.
Well, welcome. Welcome to the Catholic Church.
Thank you. Appreciate
welcome it. Home. I love what you had said there, though, about how, you know, there's no real way around it. It's either paving our path to hell or it's paving our way to heaven. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in our culture, our sometimes soft culture, we don't like to hear things very jarring like that or seemingly too harsh. And I think sometimes as Catholics in our relationship with money, we have often just never been taught how to bring Jesus and the teachings of the church into our wallets. We look exactly like the culture around us, minus maybe we give a few bucks to church or to a charity every so often. But even the statistics for Catholics giving, it's like 1% of their income.
Rubbish, isn't it? Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, you were practically living just like the culture around us. And so what would you say to a Catholic listening to this who maybe wants to look different and bring Jesus and the truth of the church into their pocketbook?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the first thing to realize is that we often get in our own way when thinking through issues. So you might hear, you know, every 4 years when the preacher stands up and he says, you know, we got an election coming. You know, you got to vote according to your conscience. The church is big on your conscience. But the important part of all that is that we not only have a responsibility to follow our conscience, but we have a responsibility to form our conscience, to make sure that we actually know the truth that the church has taught us and has given us to embrace. And so that actually isn't something that's perfectly self-aware. It's not just obvious to the common person. Christ really had to descend, to become incarnate, and to teach us firsthand so that we might be able to have access to these truths. We have revelation for a reason. It all is reasonable, but that doesn't mean that we're going to get there on our own. We really do need the help of grace and the magisterial teaching of the church to get us there. So I think that's the first thing to say as a general overview, is that we actually can't think through this stuff on our own. But thank God we got an answer to a lot of that, because we have 2,000 years of Christians going ahead of us and thinking through it. And as it pertains to finances generally, economics was considered one of the three moral sciences of the church forever. And still today, it's still considered to be a moral science, something that has to do with our behavior and our behavior insofar as it is virtuous or vicious behavior. So there's a lot that's said about it. And because it has to do with faith and morals, it's also authoritative. So the church, realizing that these are authoritative claims, have taken it really seriously and given us a lot to ponder. So that's the first kind of thing that we'll say, and we'll kind of get into the details, I'm sure, as this conversation goes on.
For so somebody out there, okay, you know, I in some ways the conscience is our map through, right? Like, oh yes, follow the map, do what the GPS tells you, but we need to make sure that the maps are accurate, that they are well formed. What is just an easy way for people to get started on, like, okay, well, yeah, how do I know if it's formed? Where do I go to form it? How do I do this? What can you say to that?
Yeah, great question. None of this can be done without prayer. The whole point of this is actually to have God written on our hearts, which is actually St. Maximus the Confessor's definition of virtue. But that also, you know, cannot be done without prayer. So the first place we have to do, if we're going to pick up any book, is to open that up with prayer. I really recommend the social encyclicals of the last century. So Quadragesimo Anno by Pius XI, it's a gold mine. I think Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, it's a gold mine. Laborum Exercens and Centesimus Annus by John Paul II are just, you know, a beacon of hope for so many of us. I think that's a fair starting point. They're radically different than anything that you're going to hear from the culture. They're ignoring the false dichotomy between, you know, communism and capitalism. They're ignoring the systems approach more than anything to getting our finances right. That if I just tick these boxes, if I do these things, their major concern is about getting their flock to heaven. And the way that we get to heaven is through cultivating this life with Jesus Christ. And to speak about virtues, which might sound a little too ecclesiastical for some of our ears, virtue is nothing more than that. That's just coming into a life with Christ. So to maybe pick up the beat a little bit, I think that's the way of doing it. But, you know, even if you go through Saint Thomas Aquinas's, his questions on the economy and the Secunda Secundi, or also and his De Malo, he has some great treatises on outside of the Summa. I think those are some places that I would recommend starting.
Okay. Thank you for sharing those.
Yeah, and we'll have certainly to those encyclicals, we'll have a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for you guys to find them if you are interested in checking them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that those are encyclicals and, you know, we've read some of them, but there's even, I think, one or two in there that I don't think I've even done the work of reading. And I know that some people can feel like this, you know, making sure you are forming your conscience sounds hard. It sounds heavy, but it's part of just doing the work that we need to do. I've been rereading St. Jose Maria Escriva's The Way recently. Mm. It's just a short little book with little punches, slaps in the face, punches in the gut, whatever you want to call it. But there's a little chapter on study, essentially just formation of yourself. And he's like, oh, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that, but you won't study. What a worthless soul. You know, you know, you've got to put the work in and make sure that you're forming yourself and you are making sure your conscience is staying sharp so that you can see the reality that's happening around you and not just be lulled to sleep.
Absolutely. He doesn't pull punches, does he? Yeah. And there's a reason why we're called, you know, disciples of Christ, you know, which means students of Christ, which means that this is our lifelong apostolate or vocation, generally speaking. So we are always going to be students.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Too bad school doesn't leave.
Right. It's there's no more tests maybe, but the ultimate grade is yet to come.
Yeah, there's one big test at the end.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so outside of, you know, you've done the work, you're working through forming your conscience, making sure that it's a well-formed and in the right spot. Mm-hmm. Now how can somebody continue on handling money virtuously?
Yeah, well, the church offers us a few virtues to think about. when it pertains to the proper use of money. The first one is liberality, which is often we've kind of dumbed that down to just a vague generosity. And I think that's probably a good one to start with. There's almsgiving, there's beneficence that pertains to investments, as well as magnificence and then kind of some problems of solicitude and whatnot, or proper prudence that we have to look through. But each virtue gives us not necessarily laws to follow, because we've moved from the law of the Old Testament to having the law written on our hearts in the New Testament, from an exterior force to an interior force of movement. And it's really the heart that Christ needs, you know, has come to win. So, mm-hmm. So the virtues don't quite give us these guidelines or ordinances to follow, but there are certain features of them that do help us to turn in the directions that we should go. And so, you know, I like to start with liberality. And the liberal man is the one who knows how to spend money really well, St. Thomas Aquinas says. So for him, the liberal person really knows what every dollar is for. See, money has this design feature insofar as it's a non-revealing sign, as philosophers like to say. It doesn't tell you what it's for. You know, you look at a chair and you say, oh, okay, that's for sitting. I know that one. A bed is for sleeping. You know, the form really fits the function with those. Mm. But for money, the only form that it really has, you know, if it has any form today, if it's not just hidden away in some server somewhere, is is just, you know, some paper or some change, which the only thing that kind of reveals to us, the medievals, you know, said they were dealing with coins, is that it's easy to exchange, but it doesn't tell you what you should be exchanging for. And so that's the difficult thing about money, is that we often get lost in abstractions, because everything obeys money, as Ecclesiastes says. We think, well, we have everything right here. It's universally contained in the money that we have. And we get so stuck with not knowing what we should spend it on. And the only person that's ensured to be shackled for life is the one who can never make a decision. So money kind of leads to this shackling end, the medievals say. So how do we get out of that enshackling? Well, if money's a placeholder, then we should always know what it's holding a place for. And so, you know, we can kind of, I mean, this is kind of the basics of budgeting in a certain regard, but to be able to move beyond that, so it's not, again, just something external on a paper somewhere, but actually deeply ingrained in our hearts, is where we want to be. But this is why also the tradition calls it liberality. It's freeing, because it frees us, it unshackles us from not knowing what we ought to do. And in freedom, of course, freedom is the ability to do as we ought. So it leads us to true freedom. So I think, you know, that's one of these things that I hope, you know, is helpful to people. Sure has been for me. And it was kind of just a basic first step for the medievals and their teachings about money.
If you were to look at maybe, you know, the way you yourself handled your money in the past, or the typical American or something like that, what would you say, which actions or attitudes or habits are kind of keeping them back from experiencing that liberality in their life?
It's a great question. I think there was this idea of wanting to prove myself as a man by showing how much money I could make. And so that was primarily something that I tried to achieve in the stock market. My dad, you know, sat me down when I was 11 years old and came with a, you know, huge stack of papers and, you know, taught me the real basics of reading quarterly statements and P&Ls and all that stuff. And that was just a part of our life, you know, growing up. But that was just accumulation for the sake of accumulation, something with this vague notion of maybe I'll buy a house one day, or, you know, I'll have a family one day, and that's expensive. And that kind of continues on. And those are all true things. I did want to buy a house one day. I do have a family, you know. But I think the idea of saving with some vague idea in mind is with something that's rather dangerous, without really knowing what we should be doing. And we all need to prepare for the future. That is prudence in a nutshell. But the prudence that I've found to be recommended throughout the tradition, and that actually is in Thomas's treatise on prudence, is not just knowing more or less like how we are going to make our next dollar, but actually how are we going to be stable forever? And that comes about with true ownership. And that's maybe something we don't necessarily have to get into, but I think it really changes, has changed my perspective on this immensely. It's kind of, I came kicking and screaming into being willing to be open to the church's teaching on these things because just so much of my life had to be changed. Mm-hmm. That was a bit of a nuisance for a while. And you don't really, you know, it's true. You can't really know you can't really love something that you don't know. And I didn't know this way of life. And so I couldn't love this way of life. And, you know, just like, you know, very almost forcefully, you know, being charged with being more of a, or almost trying to be a faithful son of the church. You know, the tradition kind of took me by the hand, led me along and said, you should do these things. And once I started to do those things, I came to know those things. And once I came to know those things, I've been able to really love those things. And so I think the ownership thing was a big learning curve for me, is recognizing that our entire economic system is based upon dependence upon people that we don't know for our next meal, for our security, for our sustenance. And the church says, well, really what we should be working towards, Leo XIII says this explicitly, is having the stability and having the true means of productive property, or having productive property, the means by which we can, you know, take care of ourselves and to be able to hand those on to our kids. So I think that was a pretty radical change, because at that point you've replaced something that is a universal good, that is a non-revealing sign, namely money or stocks, you know, which is just another form of money. And, you know, as we now categorize it, and to have something real, that its form really does reveal its function. And allows you to celebrate the reality that God created and live into that more. So I think, you know, just personally to try and answer that question, that was some major tectonic shifts for me.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. So early you talked about liberality, and then you listed all these other great things. What was it? Beneficence and magnificence. All the if you could just kind of quick, like, what those all are. Just explaining it, because it's like, oh, I want those.
Yeah, absolutely.
What exactly are those?
Yeah, absolutely. Here, the medieval technique. Every virtue has its corresponding vice or vices. Mm. Because whenever we get to a particular situation, the habits of our souls, the habits that we cultivate, are going to orient us to doing one thing or another. And in every situation, it doesn't matter which one it is, there's always going to be a virtuous orientation of what we could do at that moment, or a vicious one. And so at that moment, you could go one direction or the other. And so there's always a virtue, and there's always a corresponding vice or vices. And so for liberality, knowing how to spend your money really well, there's a corresponding vices of covetousness, of just accumulating because you never know what your money's for. Yeah. Or prodigality, on the other hand, of which is just spending everything frivolously without any plan. Mm. And so on the one side with covetousness, you get a good old-fashioned pagan who just loved hoarding and building up bigger and bigger barns, as Christ said. And on the other, you get a nihilist who really doesn't think that life is meaningful, that it's not purposeful, and that there's nothing that you really want to do, that you're not freed for what you ought to do. There's no ought in their life. Mm-hmm. And so they just spend on anything. So that's liberality. Within almsgiving is perhaps the next. That actually is under kind of the broader umbrella of charity, the medieval tradition teaches us. So almsgiving is an externalization of the virtue of love itself. Now, in almsgiving, it is what it sounds like. You give alms, you give to the poor. No, what is the corresponding vice to that? Well, it's actually envy. So envy in this case is not so much focused on what the other person has, like craving their house or their car, but it's really focusing on the other person who has. And so if that, it's not so much that I want the stuff that Bill has, it's like, I want to be Bill. To the point where the envious man par excellence was Cain, the tradition tells us, you know, where he so hated his brother or looked with such envious eyes upon his brother that he even wanted to eliminate his life, thinking that he could then take his place. So in almsgiving, how do we find an anecdote to, or excuse me, an antidote to envy? Well, in almsgiving, we actually start to share our life, to share our livelihood, to share what we have, to recognize that all things truly were given to all of us and not just to some of us in the beginning, and to then use what we have in accordance with that original gratuitous gift that God originally created us with. So it starts to, instead of eliminate life, it begins to share life, which will ultimately be fulfilled in the beatific vision, as all will be in love perfectly with one another, sharing life, and whose life? God's life, with one another. So that's that one. Magnificence is a virtue that's actually not accessible to all of us. You actually have to be a wealthy person to be able to cultivate this gift. Now, magnificence, it is a virtue. It's not kind of a one-time gift that a wealthy person gives. It's not just, you know, I've been saving up forever to be able to give this gift. That is an act of magnificence, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have cultivated the habit in your soul that whenever you have a large sum, you want to give it away. You know, you want, and what, and giving it away in what way? Well, in such a way that it forever changes the pattern of your city, that you're giving a new staple to your city. Now, you could say something like, one year I'm just going to buy grain for every single person, or like, I'm just going to buy milk. Don't worry, your milk bill's like done for the rest of the year. I got you, you know? But more traditionally, the examples are, I'm building a monastery, or I'm building a cathedral, or I'm building a church right smack dab in the middle of our town. You know, that's going to change the pattern and order of our lives forever on out. But to be able to do that continually means that you're quite wealthy, you know, and because not all of us have this ability. I think an important thing to maybe recall at this point is this teaching that doesn't just show up in the church fathers and not only in the encyclical tradition, but actually shows up in the 1996 catechism as well, is that once we have taken care of all of our needs, so, you know, we're living a befitting life. We have food, we have shelter, my kids are happy, everything like that. Then everything else ought to go to the poor. Not a single dime left, not a single penny left. Everything goes to the poor after that. That's a big ask of the church, you know? And when the tradition tells us that we move from the Old Testament following the strictures of the law to the New Testament following the law written on our heart, you know, that's you know, that doesn't mean that we're let off the hook. That means that the game is, you know, lifted up to the next level. When Christ is scolding the Pharisees and he mentions to them that you tithe on your mint and your dill and your herbs, what does he say immediately afterwards? You were right to do this, and yet I want more. I was like, whoa, I got to go to my spice rack and donate? You know, I mean, that's crazy. You know, Christ asks everything of us. And I think, you know, for the magnificent out there, we do get stuck oftentimes in the rut of thinking that we just need to build up bigger and bigger barns, that my masculinity is based upon being able to build up bigger and bigger barns, to the amassment is really a goal, and not spending it because I don't want to be perceived as wasteful. And the tradition says, no, that's not right at all. Actually, you've sadly missed the entire point. Really, once you've had everything met, everything else has to go away. So the magnificent plays a really, I think, a supremely important role in today's economy. It's just hard to find them oftentimes, in part because our society itself is, you know, to steal the languages of John Paul II, has created these structures of sin that really deter us from being able to enter into that type of radical giving. Of course, that's giving for the magnificent, but that's still the same claim for all of us who are just down at measly liberality. but anyway, so those are a few of the you know, virtues and vices that, you know, we can start with. Meanness or pettiness is an opposing vice to the virtue of magnificence, where it really is you have all you need, you have more than you need, and you're not giving to those that Christ originally gave to. That's understood. So anyways, we can talk about those if you like, but
I've been keeping track of my fingers. I should have done a paper and pen of like the things I want to ask more about. But just this, so this last part with the magnificence, you know, how can somebody discern when they have had their needs met? Because I think sometimes the temptation would be you just kind of redraw the line. You know, you just keep increasing lifestyle to the degree of there isn't anymore. That's kind of what our culture teaches us, is just constant lifestyle upgrade to the point of there's never any more to give.
Totally. Yeah.
I'm always moving the line of what is life befittingly.
Right. Yeah. And a real lack of creativity in that, you know, I don't mean to be too harsh on everybody, but it's kind of like, you know, I got a job. So what did I do? I bought a car and I bought a house. Well, hey, I got a pretty good, you know, good raise at my work now. So what am I going to do? I'm going to buy another car or a better car, and I'm going to move into a bigger house. It's like, come on, there's better things to spend your money on, guys, you know? and so I, you know, again, the virtues, what do they do? As we kind of kept saying, well, they have God written upon your heart. They have the Creator written on your heart. That means that the more virtuous you are, the more creative you are. It means the more vicious you are, the less creative you are. This is, you know, I like to say that this is the reason why every dictator has the same mustache and the same fetishization of concentration camps, man. You know?
It's a lack of creativity there.
So much more you could be doing, bro, you know? So just go for the financial systems or whatever, you know? But to be able to start to discern what is enough for us actually has to come in relation to understanding ourselves, not as an individual in society, but one member of the common good. So I think this is really a thing that starts to change everything. When I think about what am I going to spend this dollar on, I can't be thinking about, well, I'm going to either spend it on myself or somebody else. Of course, that's the reality behind it. But the first thought we have to think about when holding up that dollar bill and thinking, what am I going to do with it, is how am I going to spend this on the common good of which I am a part? So why do I eat breakfast in the morning? Well, because I'm part of the common good. I have to be sustained. I need to be strong so that when I go out of my house, I'm ready there to serve my community. Why is it that that I even own a home? Well, because my family has to get to heaven, that we have to have the stability and the hearth of love by which we can enkindle hearts that are prepared to enter into the beatific vision. And a home aids us in doing that. So those are not thinking about ourselves. Those are not ways in which we think about ourselves as individuals, but ways about we think about ourselves as integral parts to the whole of the community. And so when I say, like, when you ask, how do we think about discerning what's enough? I think there really has to be the answer that we are tuned in to what's going on in my city, in my parish. I think we should start to think about our cities in terms of our parish instead of just our cities. And then within my neighborhood as well, to think what does everyone need? So it's not just my needs that are first and foremost on our minds. That starts to get us out of the circle of thinking more and more about ourselves and more about all of ourselves.
I love that. You got the wheels turning there,
yeah,
huh?
That's good.
Yeah. So I think the parish thing is really an important thing because that's the first place that people turn for community these days. I mean, there's some things that we kind of have to work through with, maybe with that question a little bit or with that subject of community, but also it's the place where people turn to in terms of their needs. So we'll just kind of boast on our pastor here. We've had a couple of women in our church recently lose their husbands. So what did he do? He just, tapped on the shoulders of several families and said, all right, we're taking care of their mortgage. We're taking care of their grocery bills. You're going to pay $30 a month. You're paying $50 a month. And this is just part of your bills. Just as you have bills for your family every month, you have bills for her family because they're part of our family. And to be able, again, to think of ourselves not in terms of these as autonomous people who kind of bump up against other people from time to time, but really understanding that we are social creatures. God himself is inherently communal, three persons, one essence, and he made us to image and liken ourselves to him, and recognizing and leaning into that communal nature that he created us with is really, really important. And something that I think is very either misunderstood or not thought of at all today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As long as we're bragging on pastors, just the other day at Mass, our pastor in his homilies, brought this idea. Of course, he said it much more beautifully than what I'm about to say, but about how God came to give us freedom. He gives us freedom. He promises us freedom, but never independence. And I think, especially us, right? I mean, like, oh yeah, freedom. Independence Day, freedom. Like, aren't those the same thing? I was like, oh no, wait, yeah, we're free, to do the good thing, to live this life, to follow Him. But that never means that we're just on our own. We're not this individual unit. We're part of this much larger thing, whether it's a family, whether it's our parish, whether it's humanity, whatever it is, we are interconnected. We should behave as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is really well said. You did a great job repeating it, or you did it better. Yeah.
I think that can be hard, though. We live in a very a culture that doesn't. If you need help from other people, it's almost a source of shame. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hack it. You couldn't make it. Yep. And as if it's a bad thing to be interdependent on one another, but that's just not the history of the church. We've never been that way. And it's hard sometimes as Catholics, I think, to peel away cultural things that don't necessarily apply from a Catholic worldview.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. When St. Bonaventure, speaking about the lay life and the religious life, and the religious life as kind of the vector for the lay life, showing us which direction we should be going. He says that there's two modalities that we can all have in this life generally, and that's one of exchange and then the other is one of love. And I like to summarize this point of saying that money takes the place for where love lacks, where we can either call up a moving company and they can help me, move my piano, or I can call up my friends to do so. On the one side, I've incentivized them with money. On the other side, we've just built up love, friendship through the years. And of course, money has its place, but I think one of the major problems is that we've all started to default towards money and not default towards love, which is, of course, the default that the church commands us to make. Where are the exceptions to where love cannot really solve the issue right now? And then we have to think about how can we cultivate greater friendships in the future where we can start to rely on love in those situations. Mm-hmm. But money's the exception, not the rule in this case. And I think we do have that backwards today. I think retirement is certainly a prized example for this. And we think so much about trying to take care of ourselves to the end. But the truth of the matter is that we are either going to be taken care of by people we know and love, or people that we don't know and therefore really can't love. Might have affection for, goodwill, whatever, but in some vague sense, but not in a definite sense. And it's just that's actually quite a recent transformation in human history, and also part of human history that is sequestered to the West.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not always a cultural. I mean, in many cultures, that's not the case, where as you age, you're kind of cast away to the side because you're not useful anymore, or you're infringing on my schedule, etc. But yeah, in the West, it's very much become I've got a busy life and I don't have time to take care of you.
Yeah.
And so let's just use this pot of money you've built up and that'll just kind of suffice. And then I'll occasionally visit you. And, you know, as a Catholic, just looking at it from that harsh stance, it's very difficult to reconcile that with our faith.
Yeah, I think that's the case. That's one of those things that probably sounds too extreme to most people today or to most Catholics today. But then we have to recall that Christ calls us to radically live for him. The question's never whether or not we're going to or we should live radically for Christ. The question's only, how are we going to live radically for Christ? You know, and I think that's one of those things where the pattern and order of our society, if it were truly Catholic, would not look at all like how we've built it up today.
Mm-hmm. And just even as you mentioned retirement, so there's, you know, aging and kind of the challenges that can come with that.
Yep.
I think that our culture's notion of retirement in general sometimes doesn't always fly with a Catholic worldview. This idea of as soon as I'm 60, I'm out of the workplace. And now I'm just going to be, you know, golfing all day, occasionally, you know, spend time with the grandkids, but I'll be, you know, just constantly cruising and kicking back and watching TV, and how that is problematic to a disciple.
Yeah. Permanent vacation and a second adolescence.
Yeah. Well said. You know, and Christ, of course, gives a whole parable on this. He says, you know, a man had a surplus harvest. And so what did he think to himself? Well, I'll just tear down my barns and build bigger barns. And then he says to himself, soul, relax. You know, you don't have to work anymore. Of course, the next line comes out of God's mouth and says, you fool, tonight, you know, you're called to make an account. But I think it just couldn't have been a more perfect description of modern retirement habits, you know, of hitting the age where you can start to not work, instead of the age where you no longer can work, you know, which is a completely different way of looking at retirement. I think, and one just to toss in there, John Paul II, beginning of Laborum Exercens, kind of gives, you know, a really, really powerful line where he says that work was made for man, and it was given to us before the fall. And throughout the document, he continuously says that, why is it so important that man works? Well, because it is one of those ways in which we cultivate virtues, where we do cultivate the life with God, and that work is actually an integral, indispensable part of that journey to heaven. So if we've, and it's even an integral part of cultivating our true humanity. So we will only give up on work when we want to give up on our humanity. You know, that doesn't, you know, speak anything about somebody who physically can no longer labor. That's a completely different topic that he's speaking about. But to be able to shirk off the duty that we have to work, which means not just to get something done, but rather to actually serve the common good, to labor for it, to cultivate it, to bring it about, actually physically concretize here and now, that is absolutely indispensable to the life of grace and absolutely indispensable to the life of heaven. And so if we're going to say that that's no longer important, or I don't want to do this anymore, then that's actually a much bigger metaphysical religious question than we might have even realized in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And just for people wondering out there, you know, if they do want to quit working the day job, maybe that they've had and that has paid them at, you know, age 65, are there still options for them, though, to live a fruitful life as a disciple that doesn't shirk the common good but maybe they just don't spend their time earning a paycheck any longer.
Well, that one's a tough one. Obviously, work does not necessarily have to go along with money. I do want to back up. I promise to answer that. But I do think that the modern economy makes retirement out to be a good idea. Now, I don't mean that it's just like marketed, that people are told that you should work for this, but rather that the grind, we call it the grind, you know, it's not actually cultivating our humanity in the ways that work has in the past, that we're just cogs in a machine, that we're just going along, you know, with whatever blind market mechanism is happening at that time. And it doesn't really feel like we are, when we are laboring, that we're really cultivating true fruit. Mm. That when we're at work, when we're doing the 9 to 5, that it doesn't really feel like we are laboring for the common good. And so people just say, I want to get out of that. And they may not even like think through this all that explicitly, but they just have that natural disposition or orientation towards wanting to get out because work is not humanizing. And for that, I have so much sympathy. I have every sympathy for that, you know? And if that's, you know, the place that you're in, you know, I'm sorry. And I hope that you're able to labor out of that. Again, Leo the 13th, early on in Rerum Novarum, speaks about this very thing, is that we need to work so as to be able to free us to be able to work better for the common good. So I absolutely, there's that way of working and that hope to have. Now, working for a paycheck, I mean, it's an interesting concept in a certain regard, because if you think about it, and I don't mean to be too harsh on money here, but whenever we work, it's always a transitive action, John Paul II says, again, in the same document, meaning that we always work on something. You are the subject working on some object. Now, in that regard, why do you have that object? Why are you making that object? Well, usually you're making that object for someone else. You know, you're making it a gift to give to someone else. That act only becomes self-referential through money. In other words, once I make the object, I give it or perform the service, and I give it to someone else, what is actually happening truly in that moment is that I am gifting something to someone else and then saying, please pay me for that gift that I just gave you. Now, and this is all kind of explicitly said by Blessed John Duns Scotus in the 13th century. So I'm stealing this here. So that self-referentiality obviously doesn't need to be there. As you said, you don't necessarily have to work for money. But the question, you know, a really important question comes up alongside this is, if we are to cultivate the virtue of liberality, of actually knowing what all of our dollars are for, saving up, stockpiling a large amount for the future where we don't have to make money because we can just always eat out of that savings account, puts us in some sort of jeopardizing situation where we have stockpiled, just as Christ kind of warned us about doing so, against doing so. You know, we can get precise on numbers and everything like that, and I think that's probably a solution for a lot of people. But there is some jeopardy, you know, you are like putting yourself in the occasion of sin, and we just got to be careful about that. So that would be my only kind of forewarning there.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
And push back on me if you disagree with it too. I'm happy.
Well, I was just thinking about, we're reading a book right now about the life of Saint Louis Martin and how after his wife's death, he basically, you know, sold his home. They sold the business. Him and the girls, the five girls still at home, moved to be closer to family. And then he never again worked a job per se. Oh. He was extremely generous, you know, with the proceeds from those sales, but he set enough aside. And I think this probably strikes that balance. You know, he set enough aside to kind of prudentially not be able, not to have to go work, because then he focused on raising his girls, making sure they received a Christian education. He was involved at the parish. He went around and helped the poor in the area. basically he created a different job for himself because he didn't have to go work for a paycheck. He just challenged himself to go find where he could be fruitful as a disciple. And then he literally raised a saint. So I think that, you know, there was, it worked out for him. But I think that a lot of us wouldn't go so far to ask ourselves those hard questions and to, you know, make sure we are that diligent with our time in those, in a situation where we don't need a job any longer.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. It does, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves, you know, and we're not going to be able to get to any good, you know, good answers if we're really not like looking deep in our souls and saying, you know, and doing the proper examination of conscience and saying, mm-hmm. you know, why am I actually doing this? And I think most of us really want to work. We want our work to mean something. Yes. And so to be able to hit 60, and obviously that's a dream, you know, to have so much money that you can just go around being, you know, the tooth fairy, the people in a certain regard, right? I mean, that's awesome, you know, but there's a different reality that I think most of us will find where we might be able just to save enough to be able to start the business that we always wanted to start or join our friends in some venture that we really think is for the kingdom. And I think that's the goal. You know, Christ does not tell us to work really hard in the businesses that were set up by the kings of this earth, but rather so that one day we might be able to go around and be the tooth fairy, the people. He really wants those businesses to be completely different. And we saw that. We had 1,000 years of that in church history. So it's not just kind of pie in the sky, a potential that can never be reached, a utopian you know, fiction. This actually happened. You know, to be able to see what is real or what is possible, you have to look back and see what was actual. That was actual. We could do it again. And to be able to live in such a way as we're bringing the kingdom of heaven here on earth, you know, which can only be done through prayer, which can only be done through the sacraments, you know, but it can actually really be done. That's the goal. You know, that our businesses reflect his face in some way. Mm.
And when you say the 1,000 years, are you referring to kind of the chapter in Catholicism when, you know, we built the schools, we built the hospitals, mm-hmm. we built cities?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we always fearlessly placed Christ at the center of those, but we were still at the service of the common good of all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Andrew Willard Jones, a relatively popular book called The Two Cities, walks us through the church history in that regard really well. I'd really recommend that to anybody mm-hmm. who's interested in this period and those around it. Like, how did we actually achieve that as Catholics? How did we produce that? You know, and then also, like, how did we get away from it? How did the fall begin? And so I think he answers those questions really well. But, you know, just kind of to give a long and a short of it is that we really had to be willing to choose love of neighbor over love of self, to be able to say, you know, we assume Christ, that we don't have this private life that stops as soon as we leave the front door to the public square that's naked and open and we just can have shared ideas. We're not just called to have a Catholic worldview. We have to just recognize that the world is Catholic and then we have to live according to that and to be able to live into that. And one of the ways that we can start to free ourselves up from the modern strictures or the structures of sin, again, to steal the Pope's language, is really starting to prioritize relationships with other Catholics. In a very soft form of nepotism. I hesitate to even use that word, but where we really like have a favoritism towards our brothers, as we are always supposed to have a favoritism towards those closer to us. So Pope Benedict XIV wrote about this, saying that if your culture is starting to be lost to a non-Christian culture, what do? You stop working for the non-Christian. You start working for the Christian. You start hiring the Christian. Pope Saint Paul VI wrote the same thing, you know, where speaking of missionaries sent off into the third world and saying, you know, what did they do that really saved these people? Well, they taught them how to be self-sufficient so that they didn't have to rely on the predatory business practices of the West that was then going to steal their culture. So he gave, so in this one foul swoop, he gave them some sort of security in by teaching them to be self-sufficient and gave them Christ. And the former served for them to retain the latter. Mm-hmm. And there's many other examples of kind of papal attestations of this idea and saints, doctors of the church saying the same. But I think that's a really important one, is that we really need to be have this creative mindset, this entrepreneurial mindset as Catholics, to be able to maybe not prioritize, or indeed not prioritize prophets, but rather prioritize people and the culture that we want to have. Mm-hmm. Prophets are important in their own regard, but they're third at best.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Jacob, I mean, golly, I could keep going all day and tomorrow and all week, just talking about this, hearing more about it. But I do think we probably need to cut this thing down so people can,
we'll
get out of
back.
Their driveways and get on with the rest of their life, and not just keep being riveted to the radio or to their earbuds. If they want more of the same thing, you already mentioned, we've got that list of encyclicals. You just threw out that other book. Where else can people run into more thoughts like these?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why we created our think tank, New Polity. You can find us at newpolity.com. We got a steady going podcast on a whole host of different issues, everything from trying to understand the political structures of our times to a podcast series that Mark Barnes and I did called Good Money. It walks through some of these things in more details. But regular blog and whatever else you find in the think tank world over there. And if you're around Steubenville, we'd love to host you and show you around and point to some of the things that we helped get started. And we're really excited about them. And I think you might be too. Thanks.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciated just the gift of yourself and your knowledge. So thank you again. And if anybody wants to follow up, you can go to the show notes and we'll include all the links that were mentioned today. Until next time, bye for now. Thanks for joining us today. You can learn more about this show and the Wallet Wind program at walletwind.com.
Music in this episode's from Dylan Gardner. Listen to his new album, Almost Real, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your music. See you next week.